The contents of this podcast are for informational purposes only. None of the commentary in this podcast should be considered financial advice or legal advice. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual guests and should not be considered actionable, may be incorrect, and are subject to large amounts of uncertainty. Wired takes no responsibility for listeners taking action based on the contents of this podcast. Always do your own research. The presenters and guests of this podcast may have long or short positions in the assets discussed at the time of recording or at the time of podcast release, which may bias their view.
Hey everyone, welcome to Wired Talks, the Wired podcast where we discuss all things crypto. So whether you're a veteran or a crypto noob, we're all learning together. This is your host, Thomas Correa. I work here at Wired. I'm also joined by Louis Aboud, head of research at Wired. Louis, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Also joined by my esteemed guest, Josh Olsiewicz, or more commonly known as Carpe Noctem. Josh, welcome.
Thanks for having me, guys. You said my name perfectly. But on both accounts, the first and the last name. So that's like, you're a small percentage of person in this world. So congratulations on that.
Yeah. He said your Twitter name better than you wrote it.
Yeah, I always misspell it with the E instead of the O.
Yeah, so some background on that real quick. So I got this shirt like from jinx.com, shameless plug, like years and years ago, and they spelled it wrong, so that's why I spelled it wrong. And also on Gmail when it was in beta, EM was taken, Carpe Noctem, like spelled correctly. So that's my defense. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Fair enough.
Good. Josh, we don't know each other too well, but Louis and you are become, I guess, somewhat of friends this year, just trading through this volatility. So thanks for coming on the show again. For our listeners who don't know much about you, actually, when I was doing my research just to learn about you and what you do with your time, it seems like you do a few things, right? You write for Brave New Coin. You have a fantastic Twitter presence. And all of this is kind of a venue for you commenting on markets and then releasing your technical and fundamental analysis on crypto. And of course, if you're doing all of this, you must be trading all the time. So just curious, what does your day-to-day look like?
Sure, yeah. So I write for Brave New Coin, 3 articles a week on anything I choose. So there's never like any editorializing as far as like, you need to write about this or we need something about this. It's always like based on what's going on in the market, what's going on Twitter, social media, whatever. I try to get ahead of things a little bit, chart wise, like technicals, as far as things I think are going to be a decent play. I wake up, I come in my office and I'm here like literally all my waking hours almost, other than eating. I'm alone, so I'm trading. I'm on Twitter, which is why I'm always on Twitter or Telegram, because I'm just, here hanging out with the virtual world of everybody else. And that's really my day-to-day. So I'm either reading, researching, trading, talking to people, just 24/7 almost.
Yep. Do you always have a position on?
When people say position, like, depends what your point of view is. So
yeah,
some people like from funds, like hedge funds, like, and I've had to learn this now that I'm trading for a fund or trade prop trading, like their focus is USD value, which as somebody who's been around since 2013, like my focus has always been coin value. So number of coins, not number in USD. So if you consider like being in coin as a position, yeah, you're in a position. I'm always in a position. If you consider like USD being your primary value driver, then that's a different position conversation. I like to think of it as like if you're in anything, you're always in a position. I consider USD a 1x short on the market if we're talking relative value. And if you're in coin, you're thinking that coin's going to be worth more, right? So I think everybody's always in a position if you're a trader, regardless.
Yep. I guess no position is a position, yeah. To a trader, like exactly. You said. That's really interesting. So how did you get involved in trading? What piqued your interest in trading? From what I've gleaned online, it seems that you're fully self-taught, and then now you're putting like educational materials and teaching new traders that are coming into Bitcoin and even like traditional trading. How did you teach yourself trading, and what piqued your interest?
Yeah, so like I said, 2013 is when I first got into Bitcoin. I think it was either Reddit or Slashdot, some article. The real clincher was the congressional hearing at that time, where they basically said it's not all for bad things. Like, there's, you know, Jerry Brito was there, some people from Ripple were there. If you go back and watch it, it's a pretty interesting conversation. But so yeah, that's when I first bought Bitcoin. And I think naturally, because most people aren't used to exchange like volatility or currency stuff, like at least in the U.S. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong there, but the fact that it was so volatile and there was so many possibilities to like buy low, sell high, that naturally I think people gravitate towards trading it in a retail setting. So that's how I sort of gravitated towards trading. I found a trading community specifically for crypto with people like me who are sort of new, didn't necessarily have a finance background, didn't even have like a retail trading background, just people trying to figure out what's going on. So that sort of went hand in hand with trying to figure out what the hell this new crypto stuff was. And so it was just a general like environment of fostering learning, which sounds like hippie dippy and communist-esque. But yeah, I mean, everybody at that time, everybody was super encouraging about like learning and figuring out new information and trading, you know, just everything. It was a really great time for that.
Yeah, you know, just looking back at markets, you know, I was pretty interested in trading myself around that same sort of timeline. Traditional markets were quite boring, you know, after the financial crisis. Just volatility was just not there. And volatility is sort of your best friend if you're a trader. And what got me into crypto trading was exactly what got you into crypto trading, is just that there's a volatility there, which presents an opportunity. What came first for you, the interest in Bitcoin, which piqued your interest in trading, or you were a trader first and then you saw the volatility in Bitcoin and got interested in Bitcoin?
Yeah, so the technology of Bitcoin to me was super interesting and fascinating, because like I didn't think that this digital cash thing was like the real thing. I think anybody who comes across this is always like, you know, it's obviously a scam, this isn't going to work, blah, 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 blah. Then you realize like the barrier of entry is like nothing, and anybody can send anything anywhere in the world. And oh yeah, like you can trade on exchanges. You don't have to have like a minimum amount. That was a huge driver towards getting people in as well. Sorry, what was the second part of that question?
Yeah, as sort of what came first for you, was it Bitcoin that got you into trading, or was it trading that got you into Bitcoin?
Right. I don't know. Like I was saying, like the learning thing, like people were learning about crypto, they were learning about trading, like it was hand in hand. I mean, the biggest thing for me was I had student loans I needed to pay, and I was, the whole time I was like, how the hell am I going to pay these student loans? I had a mutual fund at the time, like 10 grand or something, nothing major, and it wasn't performing. It was like OD Max, like Oppenheimer Fund emerging markets account, and I pulled everything out and put it into Bitcoin at the time, because I thought like, hey, this has a shot at becoming a thing. So eventually I paid off the loans a few years later in 2017. But yeah, I mean, it worked out. So, you know, I don't really know what came first. I just think being around people who were both learning about crypto and trading crypto all the time, because you really need to know what you're, the crypto side of things is to trade it effectively, I think. You know, like what Buffett says, don't invest in what you don't know. And so I think people were so interested and curious, like just around everything, you know. And it's such a complex and multifaceted disciplinary thing. It touches everything, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you were quite involved in this early Bitcoin trading community at the time when you got into it. What did it look like?
Yeah, so it was mainly TeamSpeak or like Reddit. The Reddit presence was massive on our Bitcoin. There was also a really decent presence on Bitcoin markets. Twitter was kind of there, but not really in the foreground, at least for me. And through the years, there's been several iterations of training communities, but all the while Twitter has sort of been the mainstay because it hasn't changed. And I think that's why crypto Twitter has become the size it's become, because there's been several TeamSpeak servers, there's Telegram now, there's Discord, there's all these private groups, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, Twitter, YouTube, like these things are not fluid. They're always there. And I think that's why they just like stood the test of time, basically.
Which was the first TeamSpeak? I can't remember what the iterations were. It was like Whale Pool, Whale Club, Stake Pool or whatever. I can't remember what the original one was.
Yeah, so it was Whale Club.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And was that, when did you start hanging out there?
That was also 2013. I don't know how I found Bitcoin Markets, the subreddit, but that's how I found the TeamSpeak. Mainly because, like, again, it's easier to talk to people about this stuff than, like, trying to figure it out on your own. And there was, there were very few people, like, less than 30 definitely at the time. And all of them seemed super knowledgeable on both trading and crypto. So it was good to just be there and listen to what they're talking about, what they're looking at, from every aspect.
The majority of traders end up losing money, right? And I suspect those who started in Bitcoin in 2013, unless they had a side pocket for hodling, a lot of them got wrecked over the years. Do you know like what percentage, you know, just off the not off the top of your head, but just like a rough estimate of those early Whale Club members that got wrecked or you know that are still operating and are successful traders?
Yeah, so most of them, most of those 30 people are still around. I talk to those people still to this day. So they've been very successful. The new crop of people that, you know, that come in every bubble, those people aren't as successful generally, because trading doesn't happen overnight. You need time. You need to have the time to trade. You can't just constantly be betting and gambling and expecting things to happen. But yeah, like a lot of those people, over 50% of those people definitely have been extremely successful, which is not common, but most of those people were also understanding of the crypto, understanding of bubbles in the market, and having some semblance of trading knowledge to be able to navigate the bear market successfully.
Yeah, I feel like some of the people that you're referring to had a trading background, right? Like they weren't naive to trading when they got into Bitcoin. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. But they weren't like you know, major financiers or prop traders, yeah. But they had like retail forex experience basically, that they poured it over into crypto, definitely.
What do you think separates a just basically a gambler from a successful trader that can repeat performance?
Oh man.
Yeah. It's more like a trading philosophy, trading routine sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean
I have a few myself that when I used to trade a little bit more actively, now, you know, my role at Wire's kind of shifted. But when I was doing that, I always had a routine for checking the markets and have some sort of like idea of like price targets basically for 1 day, 3 day, and then 3 months out or whatever, just so I can stay disciplined, I think. So basically having conviction over your positions, but then also having the humility when you are about to get wrecked to have the proper risk management to get out of that position and then, you know, quickly like get on the other side if you need to. What do you think, you know, what do you have any sort of routine around trading or any sort of like things that you do repeat to become a successful trader?
Yeah, so I think the biggest problem for most people is they are initially on way too high of leverage and betting way too much percentage-wise of their account, of their stack. They're not consistent, they're not disciplined, which is what you're getting to. They don't really know what's going on. They tend to not follow the trend. They are just too eager to trade. Like they think, you know, I'm a trader. I need to be in a position all the time. I need to always be on some side of the market. Most of what I do is waiting. I think Louis can agree with that. Like, especially these past few months before the breakdown beyond 6,200, Most of that was very minimal trading, but a lot of people who are newer might want to be, you know, trading that chop, and you're just losing money. It's just a constant war of attrition between the chop and the trend. So, early on, you know, most people, they buy the top, sell the bottom, which is the opposite of what you want to do, obviously. And that's what I did in 2013. I mean, I got in at 500, but a majority of my coins were bought around 900, you know. And then I continued to buy throughout the bear market. I didn't really sell anything until 2015 to 2017. So, yeah, I mean, most people don't have patience for that. Most people bet their rent money, their food money, you know, and that's not what you want to do either. Most people have a really low time horizon, really low time preference. They can't handle the volatility. They can't handle the fear. They can't handle the euphoria. You know, a lot of people love to hold losing positions and hate to hold winning positions, which is, again, the opposite of what you need to be doing. You need to be comfortable holding a winning position and staying with it. And like you said, risk management is huge. Not managing position size properly is another problem that I'm kind of getting at as well. So yeah, these are all like little things seemingly, but they all add up to like how to become successful.
How do you think about the kind of the dynamic between risk reward and hit rate? Are you looking to have big wins? Are you looking to have lots of small wins?
I mean, it kind of depends on the market or the trade. So like my biggest win this year was that had inverse head and shoulders, which is a chart pattern. This was a few months ago. So when I'm confident in a chart pattern or a specific setup, like I'm in heavily, position size wise, I'm much more comfortable trading trends because I can just set it and forget it and let it go. I don't know if that answers your question, but I don't know. I like to cycle my sizing based on my confidence. I think that's generally what anybody does.
Yep, seems fair.
Yeah, 100%. Just to piggyback off what you said, I think, when I was trading, if I didn't have discipline and got out of my routine, I would just avoid having a position altogether. Because without the discipline, you just don't have the conviction. And then you get fearful when you're in a position that is moved against you significantly. And then risk management, kind of the wheels fall off the wagon. So for me, at least, I think discipline's been just really, really important in staying focused on the market. And if you don't have that, then just better to now have a position. When you are trading, you're obviously been around for a while, and I suspect that Bitcoin is the primary instrument that you're trading. What other crypto markets are you looking at outside of Bitcoin? Do you use instruments outside of the spot market, like options or futures?
Yeah, so I trade futures. I won't say where, but I do trade futures. I haven't gotten into options yet. That's something that's completely foreign to me. I know Deribit offers that, not to Americans, but that's one place you can trade options. Futures are great. Futures are how I learned to trade, so it's kind of my most comfortable setting. For me, spot markets are like extremely low risk because you're not really you're losing money if it's the trade's going against you, sure, but you're not getting margin called, or you know, it's not running away from you quickly in the most part, versus if you're wrong on leverage, you're really long sometimes. So I think that's helped me from the risk management perspective as well, just being a little more careful about entries, exits, setups, things like that.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure this varies situation to situation, but what's the typical amount of leverage that you exercise on a position?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, because a lot of people, they like I said, they go way too high, and they lose everything. I found for me, my wheelhouse is 10x or less. I think most people are mainly successful on 10x or less. Certainly some people can ride that dream of 50x or higher and have a massive hit rate and like zero drawdown, but that's just not me.
Yeah, I mean, I think BitMEX got us into the mindset that anything over 10x is actually feasible. I typically stick with between 4 and 7. So on moving on to BitMEX, is that a market that you are active in?
I don't know how to answer that. So I'll say this. I'll say Americans cannot trade there and should not trade there. I am very, very aware of what goes on there and the market that is put forth there. I'm very aware that they're the highest volume out of anybody right now. So they're worth paying attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the traditional space, the derivative markets often dictate the spot price and you know, the notional values are multiples of what's actually happening in the spot market. I think it's interesting that amount of influence BitMEX is starting to have on the spot price. So, like, you know, we saw the Ethereum perpetual contract being listed, and then, you know, a market to short Ethereum come on, and of course the price of Ethereum kind of falling after that. I don't know if it's a cause and effect thing, but Josh, like, what do you think? And this is kind of for Louis as well. What do you think has been the influence of BitMEX so far in these markets, and how do you think it's going to propagate going forward?
Yeah, so I think derivatives are great for price discovery. They're great for hedging. They're great for allowing people to trade multiple products, you know. But if you look at what adding a coin on BitMEX has done, every coin that's been added on BitMEX has sold off since the addition, much like Bitcoin has after the addition on CME or CBOE. That was obviously a market cycle as well, but in general, these basically, CME is a paper market. They don't necessarily throw the spot market around too much, but I think there's definitely an influence there. When we're talking about BitMEX and ETH, so that's a quanto, which means it's not denominated. You don't need to hold the underlying to trade ETH, the ETH contract there, or any other alt there. It's only BTC. Everything's position-wise is BTC. So you're not holding any ETH there. And we've seen some strange stuff happening. if you look at the open interest of ETH versus the other contracts, the ETH contract is consistently at all-time high as far as historical open interest. If you look at the funding rates for ETH versus BTC, the funding rates are consistently favoring shorts over longs, which suggests that there's continual higher long interest versus short interest there. And yet we've seen, you know, price just continue to dive down.
Does that feel right, that there'd be higher long interest on BitMEX?
I don't know what right means, but obviously...
compared to other markets, right? We get to see long versus short on Bitfinex.
Sure. So if you look at Bitfinex open interest right now for ETH, it's still spot net short. Or sorry, excuse me, it's net long, pretty much everywhere. So I think it's understandable. I think the funding rates are a little iffy. I think it's definitely gamed a little bit by somebody or someone. To put on my tinfoil hat a little bit. And that's coming from like someone who's not a fan of ETH in general. I just think ETH has been battered a lot by the BitMEX contract. Kind of like we were talking about, I'd consider it a type of rehypothecation. I don't really know what that word means exactly. But
Does anybody, Josh?
I don't know.
We actually did talk about that on an earlier podcast, so maybe you should go back and listen to
it. No, I did.
But I think what you said about the CME futures is interesting as well, because if you look back at the commodity markets, they actually experience the same cycle where when there's no futures market, like generally speaking, the CME is going to be interested in launching a futures market when there's growing trading activity in an asset, right? Because they're trying to run a business. So they're looking for markets that are moving. Maybe they're really bullish. So I think if you go back and look at the first listing of futures on a whole bunch of commodities, basically the day that they're listed, the month that they're listed is basically the year or 2 year peak of that commodity price. And I think a part of the function of that is that it creates a more two-sided market. I mean, there was a two-sided market in Bitcoin already because you've got, you had, you know, OKCoin futures and, you know, BitMEX was small until sort of January of this year. But, you know, there's always been ways to short Bitcoin since like early 2015, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But do you think that like the increased ability to short markets has impacted the price, or really it was just a coincidence?
I mean, I think it's definitely impacted the price, but I think it's good for the market overall, because then we're not seeing this, you know, one-sided markets tend to go haywire quickly. But yeah, no, we've been able to short the higher market cap stuff for a long time, even though people in mainstream media or people in legacy markets who aren't aware continually say, like, if I could short this thing, I would, like Bill Gates said that, I think. It's like, well, Bill, you can short it. Like, you just have to know what you're doing and trust certain things. Like, yes, there's not custody yet, which was kind of a big deal at the conference we were just at, Consensus Invest. It was all about custody. And I can understand that. It's definitely a big deal. But yeah, if you wanted to short it on like your personal account, you could definitely short it on a personal account.
When I first got interested in trading crypto, I was surprised by how useful technical analysis is in trading something like Bitcoin markets or something like Ethereum markets. And I suspect it's because, you know, efficient market hypothesis and all, like the Bitcoin markets are not very efficient, right? There's certainly some sort of manipulation that was going on perhaps in the past. Now it's a little bit more cleared up, but all of the different information is just not reflected accurately in the actual price, which creates a good venue for technical traders. You are renowned as somewhat of an expert in technical analysis, and I think if you go on your YouTube channel, there's just so much content for new traders getting up to speed. Why do you think technical analysis is particularly useful in crypto, and what are some of your favorite indicators?
Sure, yeah. So I'm not an expert, but thank you. I always tell people, look, I'm just some guy who, this is all I do. So if I don't know what I'm talking about, I feel like that's a failure to me. But to that point, thank you. The manipulation thing, Jay Clayton brought this up at the conference. You know, he talked about the ETF and how he doesn't want an ETF and there's manipulation. But there's manipulation is never going to not exist. It's in all markets. It's clearly in FX markets. It's in stocks. It's in, you know, it's all over the place. So whatever. Yes, there might be more or less at certain times or more or less in certain products or certain exchanges or whatever. So there's that. I was going to mention this earlier, but like the best part of crypto is it's 24/7. The worst part of crypto is that it's 24/7. So there's always something going on. And because of that, like around the world, there's always something going on. So because of that, there's massive information asymmetry. You know, when we get hacks in Asia, we might not hear about that for hours or days later. When things happen here, it doesn't always propagate, you know, throughout the world immediately. That's another reason Twitter's so great, is because you can see all this stuff happening in real time. You can follow the exchanges. You can follow people watching everything, watching wallets. It's really good to capture information in that way. The TA thing is interesting because a lot of noobs, like me especially in the beginning, gravitated towards TA because it's something that you can like make this checklist of, and, like check off boxes and sort of be disciplined in that respect. I think it's worked so well in crypto because there isn't really a lot of fundamental analysis, at least there wasn't at the time in 2013, because everything's new. Now that Bitcoin is 10 years old, we're developing a little more fundamental types of analysis, like NVT, which is similar to PE ratio. Not my favorite thing to look at, but it's something. Things like hash rate, difficulty, transaction data, value of transactions, stuff like that. So that all exists and will continue to exist. But for many people, how price and volume interact and look is an old thing that has been around for hundreds of years, and people are seeing that and used to that in other markets, so they can port that over, like I was saying, with the FX people especially. And these things aren't going to change going forward either. People always say, like, there's more entrants that are institutional now, that it's going to get harder to trade. There's more quants, there's more blah, 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 XYZ. But to me, like, I'm still seeing the same stuff I've always seen. I'm still seeing patterns. I'm still seeing trends. I'm still seeing everything that's always been there. My favorite indicator is called the Ichimoku Cloud, which is a trend following sort of indicator. Lets you know entries, exits, stuff like that. That's really my bread and butter. I don't know why I gravitated towards that. I think because it's kind of complex and hard to figure out what's going on. But it's really helpful at, like, surveying a lot of stuff. That's the other thing about crypto. There's USD pairs, there's BTC pairs, there's ETH pairs. There's, like, 5,000 total pairs or more, who knows. But when you're cycling through all this stuff, you need something that's, one, automatic, two, instant, and three, that you can read really easily and be confident in every single time you see a signal or a setup, which is why I like stuff like an overlay, like the cloud, for example.
Yeah. What we could do for our listeners is link to a YouTube video of you explaining the Ichimoku cloud. It's, since this is an auditory exercise, it's somewhat hard to go through technical indicators without a pen and paper in front of your face. In your experience, you alluded to fundamental sort of metrics kind of popping up now in crypto markets. In your experience, has any indicator, has any metric been a decent indicator for predicting Bitcoin price? So whether it be NVT or hash rate, is there one that you use more often than not that's worked out pretty positively for you?
I don't think there's any one thing, and like I want to hear Louis' opinion on this too, because all the fundamental stuff, just like price, can be manipulated as well. So it's really hard to like nail down any one thing. Like if you look at transactions per day, for example, across all these cryptocurrencies, assets, whatever, it's kind of like apples and oranges with a lot of this stuff. Louis and I have talked about this. Like if the fees are zero, then the transaction data might be meaningless, like for EOS, for example, versus Bitcoin, where transactions are relatively expensive compared to everything else. So that data might be a little more valuable because those are probably real, quote unquote, transactions because they aren't cheap. I don't know. News, for me, news is really big. Just because news drives a lot of this stuff, exchange listings drive a lot of this stuff. I like to use like news aggregators. I don't know, Louis, if you use anything like this, but I like it's called Cryptocurrency CCNF. Let me just look it up real quick. Yeah, but Louis, go ahead. What do you use for news and metrics and things like that?
So I mean, on your point about the fundamental metrics, I totally agree on. Basically, as soon as people figure out what people are looking at, then you're going to see those metrics start to get manipulated. The thing is that I always thought the gold standard was the number of transactions per day for Bitcoin, mainly because it costs money to do a transaction. And there was a really solid trend when I first started looking at Bitcoin, and it wasn't matching price, right? Because in 2014, price was going down, but transactions were going up, and that just seemed fundamentally like an attractive bet. But then, the block size debate started, and it was pretty obvious that the network was getting spammed, and it was really hard to sort of see what was going on. And then after that whole thing kind of blew over, I think it's fair to say now what we're seeing with Bitcoin transactions appears to be less manipulated. There has been solid growth in the last few quarters, despite everything that's happened with price. I'd like to think that that's totally organic. I hope that it's totally organic. I did a calculation the other day, actually, how much it would cost to pump the volume 20%. This might be totally wrong, so I'm just going off memory, but I think it's something like $50,000 in fees a day, USD. So it's not cheap, But if you're a really big trader, I mean, if you're like a really, really big whale, like you've got billions of dollars in Bitcoin, you might spend that money to show that there, or to try and demonstrate that there's underlying growth in the protocol. And if you're talking about a network that's, say, done an ICO and you've got extremely concentrated token ownership, like, for instance, Tron or something like that, the incentives for manipulating all of the on-chain data are just too high, right? And I totally agree that any metric that can be fudged in this space will be fudged, because a lot of the time it can be done in a profitable manner, and that there is such a large concentration of ownership, it can be worthwhile, spending money to fake data in order to move the market materially. That said, I think over time, you know, people will figure out, I think it's going to take a very long time to say, for instance, people to figure out what's going on, how the metrics on the Bitcoin network, how they should be reflected in price. I think that's going to take decades and decades, just as it took decades or hundreds of years to figure out, you know, how to value companies fundamentally, relatively. All of these things take a very long time to develop. And the fact that, like, for other crypto networks outside of Bitcoin, the fact that they all have totally different properties, economic properties, that just makes it so much more complicated, right? Like, you know, companies might have different revenue models and things like that, but they all have a P&L, they all have a balance sheet, and all that stuff is kind of like for like. But yeah, in terms of the like news, how to get new information, I think for project specific stuff, if you know how to kind of get rid of the spam, I find Google Alerts pretty good. But you have to know how to kind of filter out the trash that gets delivered to you. Twitter is like the best place for aggregating anything that is material that is important. Will have a really big conversation on Twitter within half an hour of it occurring, and a news article coming out. Do you think that's fair? Like, the reaction time on Twitter is really, really quick. You're not going to miss a lot if you're using that as a primary news source. In terms of like editorial content, I think it's all relatively low quality. I think there's a bit of consensus around that. I find what individuals that work in the industry as, you know, developers or business people or whatever, traders even, they have a more nuanced and expert view than kind of the media folk that produce, you know, news content for a living. And they're also, the incentives around why people write what they write on certain sites versus what people sort of blog under their own name, I feel like there's a misalignment of incentives for both, but at least it's easy to figure out what's driving somebody's personal biases when they're, say, blogging under their own name, than it is when they're a staff writer for CoinDesk and they're writing a puff piece on something. It just becomes a whole lot more opaque. You know, why are they writing it like this? Have they been paid? Who knows? That applies to pretty much every other crypto news site. So it's tough. I think the mainstream coverage is pretty terrible as well. So I would encourage people trying to learn is to find the industry experts that work in the industry and not just commentate on it. For instance, somebody like you who actively trades rather than Tone, who's put one trade on the last 2 years. it might sound ironic. Why would you want to listen to people that have a position, have vested interests in particular projects, etc.? It's about taking all of the opinions and comparing them to each other. I feel like news sites, really, you don't really get that granularity. You don't know what side people are on, and it just becomes a whole lot more opaque and kind of conspiratorial as well. But yeah, that's kind of my two cents on the current state of the media. I think it's going to improve, but people need to figure out a good business model for it as well. So I don't think anybody's done that yet.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, it's you know, CoinDesk specifically, like, they have their own interests that may have bias. These other sites may have specific bias to Ethereum or Tron or whatever, or just like being paid to write articles. People don't always know those biases or those connections. You know, it's not readily apparent to people new in the space. And that's, like, news specifically, like, early on is why I started doing what I'm doing now, because I was just so fed up with all the crappy news that was being put out or all the garbage TA that I was seeing everywhere. I was like, man, I really need to just put my two cents in places where I think I have value somewhere. Based on what I'm seeing. So that's really what I'm continuing to do, is just like this Tether stuff, for example, just continually seeing unfounded stuff. Like, yes, it's okay to be skeptical. It's okay to say, like, we need more of X, Y, and Z. But, like, some of this stuff is just unreal as far as what people are saying and doing around certain things without any information at all. That's really why I'm here, I feel. Like, how I got to where I got was specifically because I'm an active person behind the scenes as far as a trader, but I felt like I needed to contribute to the community in a positive way to sort of tamp down this insanity that I'm seeing most of the time.
You know what I think is really interesting is that, coming from a background of the stock market, you know, which is a fully institutionalized space, just the level of activity that occurs on kind of social media and the internet with respect to crypto markets has created such a massive opportunity for manipulating people's thoughts and opinions, right? Like, proper propaganda, prolonged propaganda campaigns, pro, against everything and anything, which doesn't really exist as much in the traditional space. Like, you might get a journalist or two that have like a pet hate, like the Wall Street Journal guys want to take down Theranos, or it's not a listed company, but whatever, you know, people having a go at Tesla and things like that, but it's nowhere near as involved, and there's a smaller opportunity to manipulate people's thoughts, opinions, and possibly trading behavior. Do you see that as being something that... Do you agree with that? And do you think that's going to continue to be an issue? And do you think that kind of propaganda is effective?
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. I think it's super effective, mainly because it's people, it's a lot of new entrants who don't know anything about markets. They don't know anything about crypto. All they see is the hype. Yeah, so that sort of thing is super effective. And that's another reason why I try to, like, right the ship in my little space of social media by commenting on certain things or certain issues that I feel are just, like, completely ridiculous. Yeah, so I 100% agree. I think that'll continue to happen. I mean, the Bitcoin Cash thing is a prime example of that. And it's digital cash, so it's not Bitcoin Cash, but it's crypto is like digital whatever. So I think it's natural that there's a higher presence of digital stuff surrounding it. You know, I don't know. Like, you know, I mean, I think of stocks and equities and whatever, bonds. I think of, like, these stodgy guys in suits in a smoke-filled room, and not necessarily young people, millennials, discussing, like, certain projects or certain people, you know?
Yeah, it's a weird thing, because I feel like a lot of people in this space are very cynical, but they're cynical but not critical. You know, they're quick to be cynical, but not quick to really get deep and analyze the facts, which I think is a weird phenomenon that is reflected in a lot of different parts of global society right now. But that's an aside.
Yeah.
Yep. Just moving on to sort of market events. So everything's shitting the bed. Why'd you do it, Josh?
Sorry, what was the last part?
Why did you do it?
Why did you make the market shit the bed? Why are you doing this to us?
Yeah,
you know, deep down, I want everything to go up forever, obviously. But I'm gonna trade whatever happens. There was, throughout this year, there was certainly growing evidence for things like a Wyckoff accumulation period, which would have meant more up than down. Towards the last couple of months, that theory kind of broke down a little bit more and more. And obviously what we're seeing now is the opposite of the cause and effect of Wyckoff accumulation. So it clearly wasn't that, you know, and I'm fine with being wrong. I'm fine with being called out for being wrong. I'm fine with being trolled 24/7 for everything I do and say. Like, I don't care. Like I was saying last night, I'm really, the other reason I'm on social media is to help my P&L, you know, go up rather than down, which is why everybody should be on social media for crypto related things. And I feel like a lot of people aren't there for the right reasons, or are kidding themselves, or are just self-sabotage by, you know, not understanding what people are saying. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. Why did I make it go down question?
Sort of rhetorical question. I mean, you know, I wasn't too surprised to see the volatility that we've seen in the last few weeks. I suppose I didn't think it would just happen in such a short time span, but sometimes you just can't fight the tape, you know. There's clearly a trend going downwards, and then if you just rewind to the event, you know, like the price charts from 2013 to 15, it's almost exactly what happened then. Louis, what are your thoughts on the volatility that we've been seeing in the market?
Well, I mean, something that I learned from TA people like Josh is that, you know, in crypto markets, I think you can actually put TA first in a lot of examples. I saw the post-peak accumulation period for Bitcoin was a descending triangle pattern, and that's bearish. The volatility squeeze, the amount that volatility fell in kind of Q2 and 3 of this year indicated that we were going to get a massive move. I think generally speaking, people were hoping that that was going to be up, and the news flow around, you know, Bakkt and ICE and everything that's going on kind of in developments with the institutional space and, you know, baby steps on the regulatory front, you know, more ETF applications, all that stuff. It seemed like things were happening. And actually the on-chain data was looking all right for Bitcoin as well. And there's a solid amount of activity in terms of all the ICOs on Ethereum finally coming to market with their products and stuff happening there. I felt like the fundamentals were decent, but after such a massive run in the last, you know, in 16 and 17, you have to expect a really, really, really big retrace. I was surprised by the size of the move in one go. We went straight down for like however many days in a row. Generally speaking, you know, crypto markets are extremely trendy, but they don't really move in a straight line. Like, that's why bad, you know, novice traders can lose money even in very trending markets, because while the trend might be, you know, extremely bullish, you're getting 40 to 50% drawdowns on a monthly basis, even if you're going up 50x in a year, right? So usually you would expect, you know, maybe we fall from 6,500 to 5,000 and then go up a bit to retest that previous support where we were consolidating around. But we just went all the way down to sort of 3,500 without really taking a breath. And that was a bit unexpected for me. I think there are a lot of kind of previously long-only funds that shorted for the first time when we started to break down. How that'll be reflected in the trading activity over the next few days as we're kind of seem to be bouncing a bit will be interesting. But I think people just realize that, all right, if we're not going to go up here, we've got at least another 6 months of bear, and let's just get out of the game now, sort of reconsider things down the track. And hence the sell-off was probably bigger than I expected. It was kind of like a mini capitulation. I'm not saying we found the bottom, but, you know, volume was very strong. it was a really big move. I wouldn't be surprised if it's the bottom. I wouldn't be surprised if it's not. But I think in the end, you just have to... If you look in the price history of Bitcoin, whenever we have a flat period, a period of low volatility, that's almost always followed by a very large move. So you always have to be careful when you're seeing periods of low volatility, because it's really just a coiled spring being compressed, waiting to smack you in the chin and possibly knock you out, which I suspect is what's happened to quite a few people over the last few days. The last few weeks, the moves in some altcoins as well have been pretty brutal. And I think it's clear now that projects are going to have to cut back on spending and things. So now there's like a fundamental driver for more bear perhaps. I think everybody knew that was going to be a big move. I think we were all maybe a little bit disappointed that it was down, but I was definitely surprised at how deep we went that quickly.
Yeah. So crypto likes the whole, stairs up, elevator down thing. So like going straight down isn't like unprecedented for crypto. I think I agree with you that like the percentage per day that we've gone down is a little unprecedented, and it's based on the oscillators, which are like RSI, MACD, whatever. They're showing, you know, the most momentum down we've ever had on the daily, for example. So that just shows you like the strength that things have propelled downward. I agree, like low volatility precedes high volatility, and we were seeing historically low volatility going into this breakdown past 6,200, 5,800, whatever exchange you're looking on. I think for a lot of people who are continually buying the dips on these moves, definitely got bulldozed and run over very quickly. So you know, if you're in a period of low volatility, you should be mapping stuff out for possibilities here, which is what I was doing those days leading up to this. And my favorite is what people tell me. Your TA always says we're going up and down, so it's not really helpful. And they kind of don't get it, you know. Like, I don't care about being predicting things. I care about being right when the move happens. So I want that roadmap to tell me, like, are we going to go down to 3980? Are we going to go up to 11.5? Like, what's going to happen here? And to your other point about capitulation, we're seeing all-time highs in volume on several exchanges. Mm. We saw an all-time high in CME volume, which is not necessarily an all-time high in USD volume, but contract-wise, it's certainly an all-time high. And you mentioned alts, and so Jim BTC, shout out to him on Twitter, he told me this thing, you know, BTC is the tide and everything else is a ship, you know, or a boat. So even if you're an alt maximalist, you need to be paying attention to the Bitcoin moves, because they kind of dictate the entire market. I don't think that's a secret to anybody, but
some people. I don't think that'll last forever.
Yeah.
I think in the end things will begin to decouple and become less correlated, especially smaller projects that are more centralized and have, it's kind of easier to separate them from the rest of the market. I might just rephrase something that you said before, because I think it was really important, especially in the context of TA. Obviously, none of this is financial advice, but, you know, in my mind, I think this is kind of what you were getting at. TA is about assessing the various possibilities up and down, and then once the market sort of picks a direction, that's when you act, right? Or like once the setup is there, that's when you act. It's not about knowing where the market's going all the time. It's about knowing what the possibilities are, both up and down, and planning accordingly. Would you say that's fair?
No, 100% agree. And people don't understand that for the most part, especially people who... This sounds like I'm defending myself, but again, I don't care what people say about me, so it doesn't matter. But like people who misinterpret or don't understand certain things, you know, like a tweet, for example, or an article or somebody's chart on a Telegram room. Most people don't understand that it's about mapping that possibilities, understanding, I should get in here, get out here, rather than I need to predict this move exactly. You know, when markets are zero volatility, I don't really want to take up a massive position one way or the other. So it was certainly the trend indicators like Bollinger Bands and Cloud and EMAs had a bearish bias leading into this breakdown. You mentioned the descending triangle. That was also there. But I still, personally, I wasn't going to take a massive position until the breakdown happened.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. So both you and Louis were at Consensus Invest. Mm. I think the biggest highlight there, I wasn't there, but that was the fact that Jake Layton was presenting to the audience.
Very good of him, I'll say as well.
Yeah,
like, that's not something that should be sneezed at, him sort of coming there to a crypto conference and giving his frank opinion to a whole bunch of people.
Give us a breakdown of you know, what he preached to the audience and what were the key takeaways?
Sure. Yeah. So I think in general, like, the first thing I noticed was the lack of attendance compared to the previous Consensus, even the previous Consensus Invest, which was a year prior to this one. I haven't heard the numbers yet or seen the numbers. I asked for the numbers. We'll see if they give us the numbers, but I suspect it's more than, you know, less than half of the people at Consensus in May. So
let's put it this way: Barry Silbert didn't tweet out the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't tweet out the numbers, which is a bearish signal right there. But I don't know, like 1,000 or less, maybe. What do you think, Louis?
Yeah, I'd say so. The Jay Clayton, the main ballroom that it was in. I didn't go to the previous Consensus Invest, but I was at Consensus in May. But that was a much larger venue. The main stage at Consensus Invest this year was much lower capacity than the main stage at Consensus in May. It was, yeah, I would say probably around 1,000, maybe even a little bit less, just in terms of like the attendees. The biggest delta that I saw was actually the amount of kind of companies and obviously the big one, ICO projects, right? Like, Consensus in May was just such a shit show with the amount of trash projects and companies, you know, trying to, you know, sort of rape and pillage in the bull market, right? Seeing that totally disappear, and I mean totally disappear, is really, really encouraging. I think the regulatory piece is significant for that, but I think it's just a function of the market cycle. But it does show that there are no more of these people to leave. I don't know if you would agree with that, but I'd say most of the people that are looking to enter the space to do dodgy things have changed their mind, and now they're probably like, let's launch a cannabis oil company or something like that.
Yeah, no, I agree. The absence of ICO presence was definitely apparent. There were still a few. Most of like the booths were like custody or trading related, so like wallets, software wallets, hardware wallets,
picks and shovels everywhere, but no gold.
What was that?
Yeah,
picks and shovels everywhere, but no gold.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, picks and shovels everywhere. Yeah,
I mean, this conference is known to be an investor conference. Basically, a bunch of crypto funds and related kind of entities are there. I think one thing I noticed from looking into Consensus Invest this year was, like Louis mentioned, there's obviously less speculative ICO projects trying to raise money there from the crypto fund audience. But a lot of these projects that had raised money last year or in prior years are now in market with a product. So think like Compound is out in market with their, you know,
they didn't
product.
Do an ICO, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, Dharma has something. And you think those projects are out there now trying to market to crypto funds to start playing around with what they've built?
I didn't see that. There was a piece, I think it was with the Tetris guys talking about borrowing and lending. I think maybe that was just like OTC trading. So like if I just want to OTC short something, I don't think it was like focused on Dharma or Compound or any of like the decentralized products. I didn't really see a big presence of ICO projects that have come to market, marketing their services there. There are a lot of the people were there, and perhaps that's just kind of the nature of the game now. People will just rock up to the conference and talk. Everybody knows each other now, right? So you don't really need to pay for a booth and market to people you've never spoken to before. The community's tight enough now where I think most of that kind of business development occurs on a more personal level. It happens at the drinks hosted by BitMEX after the event, not at like a booth at the event, which is, you know, unfortunate for Barry and the Consensus team, because they're probably not making as much money selling booths. But I think overall, there was a presence of those people there. It's just not as visible.
Understood.
You know who I didn't see? Looking back on it, was kind of weird. Like, there was no Coinbase people there. Did you see any Coinbase people there?
Not to my knowledge. In fact, there weren't many people from the... I take that back. There were quite a few exchange people there. But there wasn't a big presence of exchanges, but I definitely noticed people walking around that work for exchanges.
Yeah, definitely. But back to what Clayton was saying. He can't say anything specific, but I agree, like, him just being there was a plus. I don't know. Like, it's hard to read anything that guy says. It sounded to me like he was more bearish on the ETF than originally people may have thought.
He agrees with my article.
Sure.
Unlike some people, Josh.
What's that?
Unlike some people.
What, the ETF article? Did I read it and disagree?
You're a permeable on the ETF, aren't you?
I think it'll happen eventually. I don't care when it happens, but it's going to happen. I don't know. I think speculating on like when it's going to happen is useless as well, because it'll happen when it happens. Like, whatever. But it's going to happen eventually. I can't really remember anything like that stood out to me that he said other than the ETF comments and maybe the X.
I thought there were a few things that were interesting. I mean, the main thing with the ETF is that he was very clear that too much of the volume is occurring on unregulated trading venues. He's not saying that the prices are manipulated. He's saying perhaps they could have been, but we can never know if there's no surveillance, market surveillance. If exchanges don't agree to give regulators the data when they request it and as they request it, they can never enforce against manipulation. I think what you said before, all markets are manipulated, that's definitely true. The big distinction is that, you know, the reality is that people do get fined and prosecuted, probably not enough, but people do get fined and prosecuted for market manipulation, in traditional markets, think LIBOR and all these things, massive, massive fines, multi-billion dollar fines have been laid out for market manipulation in traditional markets. Regulators currently don't have the authority to prosecute because none of the venues fall under their jurisdiction. Right now, that is like a non-starter for regulators. They need to be in the game and they need to see what's going on before they're going to approve a retail-facing product like an ETF. Now, I know the Van Eyck ETF is, I think, like the minimum buy size is like, what is it, like 10 BTC or something? It's like more than a retail punter is going to come in and, you know, put some money in. It was a more institutional-focused. But it was clear that like futures is going to have to ramp, like CME futures will have to ramp up significantly, backed will have to ramp up significantly, and a larger percentage of the volume will have to be in regulated trading venues in order for them to move on to ETF. I think what he said about the ICO side of things was relatively consistent with what they've said in the past. Now, obviously, like, none of this is getting even close to legal advice. It's just kind of my unprofessional opinion on complicated regulatory matters. But I mean, it seemed like what he was saying is don't do public sales, do private sales, and then figure out token distribution after you've launched your product. Don't try and tell us something and tell your investors something else, because we'll find out and we won't appreciate that. And come through our, they've got their sort of, their program to have projects come to them, talk to them, figure out how to comply with the law. They're definitely open to dialogue. And I've always encouraged every single company or project that we've invested in, I've always encouraged them to be on the front foot with regulators, show good faith. Even if it means you make the decision to not serve the US or not sell anything in the US or do anything in the US, be on the front foot with regulators and, you know, be frank with them. Don't try and, you know, the vibe I got from him was saying, if you try and get around the laws, we're not going to let that happen. Right. I think that was pretty clear.
Yeah, definitely.
You have to comply with the law. Right.
Yeah.
And while it might be a bit ambiguous as to what that is, I think everybody really knows the crux of it. You can't do public sales to retail investors in the US. You just can't, right? It's very difficult to do that legally. So you're better off selling your token or whatever it is privately to accredited or institutional investors and bring the product to market. He used the analogy of a play. Once the play is starting, then you can sell the tickets. If you effectively sell tickets in a play that hasn't launched yet, and that's effectively a security on the success of that play. And I think he's pretty much saying launch the product. That was kind of the vibe I got from that commentary. I think what was interesting is the moderator was talking about, you know, Bitcoin, all right, it's a commodity, it's not, or maybe it's a currency, but, you know, the CFTC says it's a commodity. Ethereum, Bill, what's his name?
Inman.
He's like the head of corporate finance or something at the SEC, which is like the, you know, relative, it's the part of the SEC is it's related to capital raising, which is where kind of ICOs fall into, you know. That commentary around Ethereum and Ether suggested that even though perhaps originally it was a illegal public token sale, it's become sufficiently decentralized and the information asymmetries around the people sort of heavily involved in the project have fallen by the wayside and now it doesn't look like a security anymore. And then they got to item number three, which is XRP, right? Which is actually item number two. If you is it still? I think it is still item number two on CoinMarketCap. He was pretty much like no comment, which is, I mean, I don't know if you can read anything into that, but you know, he wasn't saying it was a currency, that's for sure.
He didn't.
So yeah,
he didn't,
I think that was basically what I got out of it.
There was definitely no clarifying commentary provided.
Great.
Yeah, it's with XRP, it's an interesting one because it's been really, really firm recently. Like the price has been firm. It's kind of outperformed Bitcoin. You know, there's some stuff happening there, like the XRapid's coming to market. But the regulatory overhang with XRP, I just haven't seen a single inkling to that clearing up at all, right? I feel like it's the biggest unknown in terms of potential dollars to be won or lost on the outcome of this regulatory decision. Like just because it's such a large asset that's so heavily traded. I think it's sort of the elephant in the room that people don't seem to talk about much. People don't really understand what the ramifications would be if it did turn out to be a security, but you know, every quarter you can read their quarterly reports. Their disclosure is actually pretty good relative to other crypto projects. The company sells XRP every year, you know, OTC. Perhaps it's not to the public per se, but, you know, all that XRP makes it out into the market and is traded by retail investors. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, but definitely no extra clarity there. Although they are getting sued in federal court in a civil case, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Yeah, I agree with you that that's XRP stuff is the biggest unknown to be answered. When that decision hits, one way or the other. I think the market will definitely respond. If it's a negative decision for XRP, it might be the end of XRP as we know it, you know, just permanently. At least Ripple Labs, I think, will go down.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't really see that product working. It, you know, with XRapid and the things that they want to do with it, it needs to be hugely liquid. It needs to be a global money, right, in order for it to work. So without traders doing their thing, it's not gonna happen, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree.
Yep. Just wanted to wrap this up. I have a final question for you, Josh. Do you have a refresh on your Bitcoin price prediction? And what are your predictions generally for 2019?
Do a refresh? Sure. So yesterday on Twitter, I was saying like much of the conversation we're having now, which is where people are just confused at what TA is and how to use it. And like, again, I don't care what you say about me or whatever. Troll me, that's fine. But like the predictions were purely based on rate of change of trend, the 33K by July thing. I don't really have any predictions for 2019 other than I agree with Louis, where we're going to see extended either sideways or sort of bearish action. I don't see us like rebounding immediately.
This isn't a massive spring.
I mean, I would love to be wrong, but I just don't see how this can just recover all that volume again. It's certainly possible. What we're seeing now as we stand, I don't think we're going to see bullishness anytime soon. I think we'll see mean reversion, which is what we're due. So we'll, you know, go sideways and then pop up a little bit. But I don't see us breaking 10K, maybe even by next year, like 2020 even. I think there's going to be some halving speculation that's due for May 2020, I think.
Bullish.
I think the ETH news regarding, not news, but like protocol changes regarding issuance and inflation and mining reward, that sort of thing. I think that's going to be bullish for price. How that's going to work itself in, I don't know. I don't think it's priced in right now. And everything else is just kind of like hanging by a thread as it is. So I don't know. Like, unless we're seeing this like massive uptick in transactional volume or trading volumes or something, like I just don't see it. I'm not like super bullish. But that's fine. Like, it feels more and more like 2015 than anything else. So that's when I bought a lot of coin, 2014, 2015. So yeah, I mean, it's fine. Like, it is what it is. Like, these are market cycles, right?
Yep.
Like, we had a chance to go up instead of down at 6,200, 5,800, whatever. We went down instead of up. So that kind of decides it, at least for me, for the next foreseeable future. I don't know, Louis, what you feel about that. I don't think in your heart of hearts.
I agree. After that much consolidation, if we broke down, I think we continue. We're not going bull for 6 months.
Yeah, and my like TA litmus tests are, is it above the cloud on the daily? Is it below the cloud on the daily? Is it above or below the 200 EMA on the daily? Like, those are very simple things.
There are no more EMAs left.
Right, like the EMAs on every level have been broken. They're crossing bearish. Like, these things don't just like reverse in a couple of days. Like, this takes a while to work itself out.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Josh. Is Twitter the best place for people to get in touch with you?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Twitter is definitely the best place, at Carpe Noctem, CarpeNoctom.
Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us today. To learn more about Josh, check out the show notes included in your podcast, and remember to subscribe to get the latest episodes. If you have any questions or comments, reach out to us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or the Wire blog, whatever works for you. If you like this episode, share it with your friends and colleagues. Thanks again for listening.